Okay, this is the fourth in our series on Bereishis. So what that means is we're now going to do our final topic, which is the children of Yaakov. Okay, the children of Yaakov. Now, as this is a more of a survey class than anything else, we can't get into great detail about most of the stories. But in a reflection on the book of Bereishis, once we get into Parshas Vayetze, which is when Yaakov comes to Lavan's house and then his children are born, the story more or less shifts. I mean, Vayishlach is kind of the transition period. Okay, Yaakov leaves from Lavan's house at the end of Vayetze when most of his children are already born. The only one that's not is Binyamin. Binyamin will be born towards the end of Parshas Vayishlach. And the narrative, in a sense, changes. Yaakov has been the focal point. In the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, he still is, because that's the encounter with Esav, when Esav's coming with the 400 men, and Yaakov's response to that fear. He divides his family, hoping that there will not be a confrontation, but if there is a confrontation, then they'll figure out how to resolve that. And then, basically, the next tale after that is the story of Dina. And it's at that point in time that we see a significant transition. So if you turn to page 180, so the background to the story is that Yaakov moves to, and you see that this is chapter 34, Chamishi. So Chamishi is the fifth aliyah. We're already in the second half of the Parsha of Vayishlach. Yaakov has moved to a place called Shechem. Some people say, if you look at the second line on the page, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Ir Shechem. There are different commentaries that try to define the word Shalem. So you see how Artscroll translates it. Artscroll says, Jacob arrived intact. And that is one translation of the word Shalem. But another translation is that Shalem is the name of a city. And as we know that there are, for example, different Beit Lechems, right? Rachel is buried near Beit Lechem, but there are different Beit Lechems. We find out later in the book of Ruth, for example, that Elimelech, who lives with his wife Naomi and their two sons, where does he live? He lives in a place called Beit Lechem Yehuda. That's Beit Lechem in Judea. But there's a Beit Lechem which is north, and there's a big debate as to where Rachel was buried. She's likely not buried at Kever Rachel. Sorry to disappoint people. Okay, Kever Rachel is a holy place because people have been davening there for a very long time. But whether Rachel is actually buried there is a subject of much debate in academia. Anyway, but it hinges on the question of where is Beit Lechem? Okay, where is Beit Lechem Yehuda? What's the difference between Beit Lechem Yehuda and Beit Lechem up north? So the same thing here. Do you remember there was a king in the wars that Abraham was involved in? Melchizedek, Melech Shalem. Okay, he was a king of a place called Shalem. So that and that city is often identified as Yerushalayim. That Melchizedek was an early king of the place which eventually became known as Yerushalayim. So Yaakov is clearly in a place called Shechem, and Shechem is not near Yerushalayim. So whatever Shalem place Melchizedek was a king of is likely not the same as this one, if indeed the place is called Shalem. But there could be another place called Shalem near Shechem, and that's where Yaakov settles. And that is the view of some of the commentaries. Okay, anyway, suffice it to say, so what happens when he's there is he tries to make friends with the people of the city. That's one of the definitions of the end of that Pasuk Yichaz, Vayichan es p'nei ha'ir. One is that he encamped before the city, but I saw a different commentary that says Vayichan comes from the word chain. What does chain mean? He tried to charm his neighbors. Give him gifts. Hi, I'm here. I'd like to settle. My name is Yaakov. Nice to meet you all. My name is Yisrael. Sometimes a little confused. I got two different names. Okay, so that's a possibility.
Shalem also mean like peacefully.
He came peacefully. Yeah. Again, there are a lot of interpretations as to what it means. That it could mean that as well. Shalem, you know, the article translation of intact probably has something to do with the fact that he had recently been injured by that in the scuffle that he had prior to meeting Esav with that Ish, you know, who may have been a Malach and all that. Anyway, so we know what happens in Shechem. Dina is abducted by the prince of the town, whose name is also Shechem, and then after raping her, he speaks to her and basically you know, tries to convince her that he loves her, and this is going to be a good union for the two of them. Well, he and his father come to visit Yaakov. Look in Pasuk Hey, verse 5, towards the bottom of the page, four lines to the bottom in the Hebrew and in the English. V'Yaakov shama ki timei estina chusam, estina bito, rather, uvanav ha'yus mekne vasadeh v'echirish Yaakov ad boam. Okay, so Yaakov heard what happened, and his sons are off in the field, and so Yaakov is silent until they show up. Now, hold on a second. We know Yaakov, right? We know Yaakov. Yaakov is not a slouch. Yaakov is not a guy who sits on the sidelines. We've seen the way he dealt with Lavan. We see the way he confronts Esav. I mean, the only reason why he runs from Esav is because he's worried about his children. He doesn't know what Esav has in mind. But if it was just Yaakov alone, I'll face Esav, no problem. This is not a man who runs from adversity. And yet, this situation comes. And what does Yaakov do? He's quiet until his sons show up. And sure enough, Pasuk Zion, okay. Now, by the way, this is they haven't yet come to speak to him, okay? Because the next pasuk says, "Vayitzei Chamor Avi Shechem El Yaakov v'daberito," that Chamor, the father of Shechem, came to Yaakov to speak with him, but he doesn't speak with him yet. And then it says that Yaakov's sons showed up, and then look at what happens. Top of the next page, they're furious, understandably so. Look at what happened to their sister, pasuk Chas. Look what he says, who is he speaking with? Itam, what does itam mean? With them. With them. He's not talking to Yaakov. Yaakov is not involved. And we know that the brothers are the ones who tell, you know, you have to circumcise, and only when you circumcise can we agree. And all the conversation which takes place here, and you know, whether it was a ruse, I don't want to analyze the whole story. That's a sheer unto itself. But the point is that who's in charge now? It seems very clear that Yaakov has taken a back seat while the other brothers are now driving the narrative. And that follows along. Now, it's not to say that Yaakov is you know, is done. Yaakov doesn't disappear from the story. He is their father. He plays a role. But it seems a little more clear that Yaakov, if we were to nominate him at this point in time for an Academy Award, he would be in the supporting act, in the supporting supporting actor role and category, rather than in the lead category. And this is a theme which carries throughout. Again, he's not absent; he's clearly present. Okay, but he's no longer in the driver's seat. And if you look at the if you look on page 184, for example. After the brothers, most notably Shimon and Levi, of course, have rout and killed many of the people in the city of Shechem, towards the end of the page, on page 184, Pasuk Lamed, it says, "Vayomer Yaakov el Shimon ve'el Levi." Yaakov says to Shimon and Levi, "Achartem osi." You have, well, arts will translate, "You have discomposed me." Yaakov is afraid that they're all going, that all the neighboring groups are going to rally against him and destroy the family. And the brothers get the final word. Bayomru, Hachazona Yases Achoseinu. Okay, should he treat our sister like a harlot? And what is Yaakov's response to that? No response. No response. Okay, they get the final, that's what it means to get the final word, right? He doesn't have a response. So does he harbor feelings against them over this? The answer is yes. He demonstrates that when he gives the blessing to Shimon and Levi in Parshas Vayechi. But it doesn't take away from the fact that he is no longer in the driver's seat. Okay. Is Yaakov respected by the sons? By and large, the answer is absolutely, he is. But at the same time, he is not watching what they're watching in the same way. And so they all come to different conclusions. What do I mean? If you the following stories after this, right, Yaakov is told by God, if you turn the page, he's told to go to Beit El, where he's going to bring him his Mizbeach, and he has to fulfill his half of the vow that he made in Parshas Vayetze. Do you remember when he left Parshas Vayetze and he had the dream? Remember the dream with the ladder? He says, if I come home and everything's in, and Rishavti b'shalom, there's the point that you were making. If I come home in peace to this place, then I'm going to turn this spot into a base that will give to the house of God. So he's told you have to fulfill your vow. Maybe some of the negativity that Yaakov and his family are experiencing on account of the fact that he didn't fulfill his vow. There is such an approach in the Torah. But what happens on the bottom of page 186 is the death of Devorah, who is Rivka's nurse. And we assume from there, and all the commentaries in the Midrash for sure, says that the death of Devorah indicates the death of his mother, Rivka. He was hoping to see Rivka again, but he never did. And then he has the encounter with God on the next page, on page 188, where he's given a promise that was given both to Avraham and to Yitzchak about having children and having the land, and he does what he needs to do there in terms of his connection to God. At this point in time, Rachel dies during the birth, or shortly after the birth of Binyamin, and the Torah on the next page, page 190, gives us a little summary. Okay, page 190, Pasuk Aves. Take a look at this. And this is something odd. You don't find this very often, but it relates a lot to the theme that needs to be carried through over here. And that is, Pasuk Aves, Vayhi Bishkon Yisrael Ba'aretz Ahi, that when Yisrael was dwelt, so what's Yisrael? Is it referring to the man or to his family? Good question. When Yisrael was living in that land, and by the way, I don't know the answer, okay? Vayelech Reuven vayishkav es Bilha Pilegesh Aviv vayishma Yisrael. So Reuven went, and then the pasuk says vayishkav es Bilha Pilegesh Aviv. That is, those words are the most, I don't want to say befuddling, I mean, I obviously just used the word, but in terms of trying to figure out exactly what's taking place over here, the commentaries are, I mean, have what I like to say is a field day. With discussing these five words. Vayishkav es Bilha Pilegesh Aviv. Because what does it mean, Vayishkav? What does it mean that he lay? What does es mean? Es could mean with, could mean next to, could mean at, could mean about. Okay? Pilegesh, what does it mean, Pilegesh? Was Bilha a Pilegesh? Was Bilha a wife of Yisrael? Why would Reuven even do something like this? What's the goal? Is he in fact sleeping with her? Or is he, I mean, I'll just give you a different example in a second. I'll give you a few different options. He slept with her. He slept on her bed, indicating, but not with her, indicating, Yaakov, there's no privacy here. Okay, go somewhere else. A different interpretation that I saw, which I found very compelling, is that Bilha was talking about her, that the word Vayishkav, I don't remember what the... There was a way of interpreting the word Vayishkav that has to do with the letters, and I don't remember if it was the letters that come right after it. Not Taflam and Gimel. Would it be Resh Yud Alf? No, I don't remember what that was, but I do remember what the context, what the interpretation was, and that what Reuven was doing was that he was going around telling everybody that Bilha was only a Pilegesh. Okay, even though she was a wife. And that basically he was doing, it was a kind of Lashon Hara, which is not excusable, but it's certainly not as brash as perhaps sleeping with his father's wife. If in fact he did sleep with his father's wife, which a lot of even the Gemara says that Reuven didn't do that, whatever he did, he put a wedge between Yaakov and Bilha, which is a problem. What was that interpretation I was just talking about? Oh, no, they're talking about her. But the point is that what happens I was bringing an example. So you know when some of the sons of Yaakov, not Yaakov, David, in the time of when David was a king, so his sons, there were a few of them who wanted to lay claim to the throne, even during David's life. So there was a struggle, and a number of his sons actually died or were killed in the context of these struggles. Avshalom was probably the one who was most famous for fighting against his father, trying to kill his father. And Avshalom was killed by Yoav. And what Avshalom did was he took over the palace and sent David on the run. And he set up a tent on the top of the roof. And he was sleeping with his father's concubines. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, why do you do that? To show that you're taking over. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, that's an important thing to bear in mind. Mm-hmm. If you can sleep with the concubines of the king, that means that you are now the king. Right? Yeah. That's basically the idea. Now, it's not that Yaakov was a king, but if in fact that's what Reuven's doing, what Reuven is trying to demonstrate is who's taking over this family, who's in charge. Okay, that's if in fact Reuven did it, which is again a large discussion. Yeah.
Doesn't it mean like when God says v'shachanti?
That's v'shachanti.
Oh, shachanti.
Yeah, yeah, that's a different word. Different word. Different word.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. No problem. No problem. Okay. So, but that would be a point. However, if you do that, what are you at the risk of? You're at the risk of being thrown out of the family once it's discovered. And what's the very next thing that we see? Vayishma Yisrael, the Yisrael meaning Yaakov heard about it, and then the pasuk actually continues after going to the end of the line. It's like in the middle of a pasuk, the writer hits the return key and goes to the next line. In the Torah, you'll see it that way. Okay? Vayu b'nei Yaakov shnei masar. Then it says that the sons of Yaakov are 12. Which means that Reuven was not thrown out, or was not rejected. So whatever it is that Reuven did, which was not good, we can definitely say it wasn't an innocent childhood prank, it wasn't something silly, it was something which put a wedge between Yaakov and Bilhah. One of the interpretations that I also find compelling is that Reuven was concerned, now that Rachel had died, that Yaakov was going to find solace, let's say, with Bilhah, who was Rachel's maid, and perhaps produce more children. Now, there was a tradition, for whatever reason, that a nation is supposed to start with 12. Right? Remember the song? 12 are the tribes of Yisrael. So Nahor had 12 children. Esau, when you combine with Seir, had 12. Yishmael had 12. That's how you start a nation. So Reuven's concern was that if Yaakov were to have more children, that he'd have to reject some. Remember, Avram had 8 sons. How many of them continue the line that we are so proud of?
One.
What happened to the rest of them? Goodbye, boys. Off to the east. Okay, that's what happened with Yishmael. That's what happened with the 6 sons of Keturah. Okay, off to the east. Avram gave them gifts, but you don't share the destiny of the Yitzchak line. And so Reuven was concerned about that. And so the conclusion here is Vayu b'nei Yaakov shnei masar, that they're all included. And that's the number. So when we look at the number now, of course we know that Yosef was divided into 2, Ephraim and Manasseh, but what happened as a result is that Yosef, of course, is removed from the list because he becomes 2, and the other tribe which remains is Levi. And Levi gets their own kind of, they're not removed from B'nai Yisrael, but their own elevated status. Right? Both the Kohanim and Levium come from the tribe of Levi, and they're in a different realm. So when we look at, for example, how they camp around the Mishkan, when we travel the Mishkan, so Levi is right around the Mishkan. You have the Mishkan in the center, you have the Levi families all around the Mishkan, and then you have 3, 3, 3, 3 on the 4 sides of the Mishkan, the 4 directions, and those are all the 12 tribes. Levi is not one of the 12 tribes. Levi, of course, is one of the 12 tribes. But the 12 tribes now have 2 for Yosef, and Levi comes their own different group, and they're called Machaneh, I mean, they're all basically called Machaneh, well, they're called Machaneh Levi, the Levite camp, but they're also called the Machaneh Shechina, the place where God's presence more directly resides. Okay, so that's just a general comment about for the future. But now let's get back to here. And then it lists them, so we get a sense of who the people are, what the tribes are, and then we're told about the Yaakov finally meeting Yitzchak, the death of Yitzchak, and chapter 36 is all the lineage of Esav. Okay, so we don't need the lineage of Esav for our purposes now, but that is the background, and as you see, Reuven trying to assert himself, whatever way that he was doing, was demonstrating, at least at this stage of the game, a way of saying, I am the leader of this family. Okay, now that doesn't pan out as well as Reuven really wants it to pan out, as we'll soon see. If you look on the page that I gave you, that's the question at the bottom. Who is the leader? And it's either, this is a big fight over the course of the rest of the book. Is it Reuven? Is it Yehuda? Is it Yosef? Okay, so now we're up to chapter 37, Parshas Vayeshev. And at this point in time, we're going to transition now to this, to the page which I gave you, and we're going to jump from spot to spot, because there is a theme which carries through much of the remainder of this book, and that is the theme of shlichus. Shlichus means sending. Sending people as a, either in some cases sending people, in some cases sending animals, in some cases sending items, but there is a lot of sending going on. Messages in some cases are being sent from person to person, or from person to people, or from people to person, and it's a theme which really carries through. I gave you here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 sources that include in it the word, or the shorish, the root, shalach, and this will carry us through. So I want to jump, I'll have you jump from spot to spot, and just to understand, I hope it's clear, but just to, in case it's not, the left number is the chapter number, and the right numbers are the verses, okay, on the list that I gave you. So let's take a look, and let's see what these things are each telling us. Chapter 37 is the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev. Those who are familiar with the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, this is where the musical starts. When Yaakov gives Yosef the special coat, indicating that in Yaakov's view, who's going to be in charge of the family, who at least is his favorite son, in a way. Anybody want to take a guess? What? Who's his favorite son?
Maybe Yosef.
Yosef. Right. Very good.
Maybe.
Very good. Maybe Yosef. Okay. Who's his favorite son? Exactly. So, this is what happens. And then Yosef has the dreams, which of course are an indication as well of his, you know, it's a premonition of what's going to be taking place in the distant future. And so that's what we have going. Now, when the brothers do not like Yosef's dreams, comes a point where they are going out of the way. They're going to be shepherding back in Shechem, ironically enough. And Yaakov sends Yosef there. So again, Yaakov plays a role, but once he sends Yosef off, he is definitely a supporting character. And the story has now shifted completely, okay? And that's what we find. So let's take a look. Chapter 37, 13 and 14. And how does it begin? The first shlichus is on page 202. Yaakov says, "Halo achecha ro'im b'shchem l'cha v'eshlachecha aleihem." I'm sending you to go to them, And in the next verse as well, "Vayomer lo lech narei yishlom achecha v'yishlom atzon. See how your brothers are doing, how the sheep are doing. Hashiveni davar, come back to me with the information. Vayishalachehu me'ayim echevron v'yavoshchema." So he sent him. So you see that he says, "I'm going to send you," and in fact, he does send him. Turn the page. Okay, Yosef is thrown into a pit. Now it's interesting that take a look at the top of the page. I know I didn't give you this as a source, but take a look at the top of page 204. So you have Reuven, okay, which is important, by the way. So we have two figures who play a role here. The first one is the first are the ones who are anonymous, and they're often attributed to be Shimon and Levi, who say, "Let's kill Yosef," but Reuven says, "No, we're going to throw him into a pit." If you look at the word that Reuven uses at the top line of the page, 204, "Vayomer aleihem Reuven, al tishpichu dam hashlichu oso." So hashlichu there is spelled with a chaf, It's not the same word as shlichus that I've been talking about. It this literally means to cast or throw, as opposed to shin lamed ches, which means to send. Okay, there's a difference. So anyway, he's thrown in there, but look at what Reuven says. V'yad al tishluchu vo. There's tishlach with a ches. Now that phrase yad al tishluchu means don't send your hand against, which is a way of saying don't kill. We saw this at the Akedah, where Avram is told al tishlach yadcha el hanar. Okay, and we saw this in last week's parsha also, I think, in Parshas Tetzaveh, with respect to the Ketores, I think it was, that if you don't, I don't remember the exact context, but it was, I think it was there, unless it was in the Haftorah, I don't remember. But it was also, I'm sorry, it was in the Megillah. Okay, L'shloach Yad b'mvakshei ra'asam, right, that they wanted L'shloach Yad to send a hand, meaning to kill those who wanted to sought bad for them. So that's what the phrase means. So it's not so much, this isn't the shlichus, but it's just interesting that word is being used here as well. There isn't a sending. And then, who is the next brother to come into the picture here? Look at Pasuk Chav Vav. We're going to get back to this in a few minutes, but I just wanted to draw it to your attention. Okay, so what Yehuda says is we don't gain anything by killing him. Let's sell him. And I know in the Megillah class last week we focused a little bit on that word v'nim karenu. Okay, v'nim karenu leishmeu. So I'm not going to rehash that now. Anyway, so that's the background. And then after Yosef is in fact sold, and it's a huge debate as to who sold him, because verse 28 is very vague in the sense of are the brothers involved. We'll just leave it for now, but you should know that it's vague and it's not clear that the brothers sold Yosef. So turn the page to 206, and the brothers want to cover up the deed, the fact that Yosef is gone, so they slaughter a goat. They dip the goat. They dip Yosef's coat, rather, into the blood of the goat. And Pasuk Lamed Beis 32. Vayishalchu es ketores hapasim vayaviu el avihem vayomru zos matzanu. They sent this bloodstained coat to their father, and told them, "Look, this is what we found. Do you recognize it?" Okay. So that's another form of shlichus. So Yaakov sends Yosef, and what gets sent back to him is Yosef's bloodstained coat. Now there is an interlude. This next chapter is skipped in the musical. Okay, Yosef is sent to Egypt, and the next thing we know, he's in Potiphar's house. But Potiphar's house, as the musical says, it's all there in chapter 39 of Genesis. But what happens before chapter 39? Chapter 38. And chapter 38 does not appear in that story at all, because it is an interlude. It's the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Yehuda and Tamar, in which Yehuda marries Tamar off to his first son, Er, who ends up dying, and then to his second son, Onan, who ends up dying, and he doesn't marry him off to Shelah. And then Tamar pretends to be a harlot, and she has a rendezvous with Yehuda, who is unaware that she is that she's his daughter-in-law. And they have twins, and the twins are born at the very end of the chapter. So if you see, I gave you three references in this chapter, because when Yehuda agrees to sleep with her, he says, "Okay, I want to pay you, but I don't have anything. I don't have anything with me." So she says to him, "Look at Pasuk Zion." He says, "I'm going to send you." It's ironic, because what did they send to Yaakov? Coats, a coat covered with goat blood. What's he offering to pay her with? A goat. Right? I'm going to send a gedi izim. I'm going to send a goat. And then she says, "Well, until that time, what are you going to, what are you going to give me? Because I, you know, how do I know that you're going to give me the goat?" So what does he say he's going to give her? Chosam chav, silecha matcha shebiyadecha. Chosam chav means your seal, right? Your real. What's silecha? Your coat, okay, which is a little ironic as well, because they sent the coat to Yaakov with the goat blood. Rabbi David Foreman likes to call these connections goats and coats. It's just kind of funny. But anyway, so you see that he's going to send. He's telling about all the things that I'm going to send you. And so they agree. Okay? So what ends up happening is, Pasuk Chaf, verse 20, after Yehuda goes home, and Tamar gets back into her regular clothing, because she had dressed up. So he did, in fact, send to her the item, the goats, hoping that she would give him back his stuff, but he does, but they can't find her, because the woman is gone. The woman doesn't exist. She was a fake, because the Tamar is back being Tamar. Turn the page to 212. So now what happens is, a few months later, it's discovered that Tamar is pregnant. How is it discovered? 3 months later? I don't need to tell this crowd, you all know, okay? She starts showing. And so Yehuda says, Hotziu of Tisarev, which is a fascinating question. What does it mean, Hotziu of Tisarev? Does he mean burn her at the stake? Does he mean that she should be put to death? I saw one interpretation that said that she should be branded, much like Hester Prynne. Remember Hester Prynne? In the Scarlet Letter, okay, because she did something, but it's not that she should be killed. Anyway, different interpretations. So, he mutzeis, Pasuk Chaf Hei, he mutzeis, she's going out. V'hi shalcha el chami elimor. She's sending out to her father-in-law. What's she sending to him? Hey, whose stuff are these? Whoever owns these things, that's the person who's responsible for my being pregnant. Okay? And of course, Yehuda recognizes his stuff, and he comes to the conclusion that he's going to let her live. Now, that, by the way, that's a fascinating that's a fascinating question. Does he say to let her live? Right, that's the question. In other words, does this Sarefa thing happen? The Torah doesn't say. All the Torah says is what Yehuda's response is. Tzaduka mimeni, she is more righteous than I am. Ki alkein lo nasakei l'sheila b'ni, because I had not given her to my son Sheila as I had promised. Okay, so what does that mean? Was she really going to be killed? And Yehuda said, "Don't kill her." That's not what it says. The Torah doesn't say that. It doesn't say. And that's why the word v'tisaref is so confusing, because it's not clear as to what was supposed to happen. Okay, so that's what we have. Okay, so far, shlichus, people sending things back and forth. This is a way of, in a way, this is, was it karma coming back to Yehuda? Because remember, Yehuda was the one who was responsible for the goat-stained coat being sent to Yaakov and saying, do you recognize this? And now what's coming to Yehuda is, he's being sent stuff, do you recognize this? Right back at him. So it's not just that Yehuda is getting kind of desserts, if you will, or just desserts, but that Yehuda is feeling it in a way which is quite significant. And we're going to see how Yehuda, when he takes on a different role, when he puts on different shoes, so to speak, that Yehuda does the same kind of thing in terms of taking language and throwing it right back at the person who sent it to him in the first place. Okay, and it's not because the person was wrong, but it's because there's information that person is not processing in the way which is required in order to achieve the desired outcome that they have. Okay, so now we continue with the musical, with the whole Potiphar story. Potiphar's wife. You know, it's funny. My one of the trivia questions that I like to ask my kids every now and then, although they know the question, we just always forget all the answers. Is who name a couple in Tanakh, in all the Bible, that have the same first initial? Okay, that their names have the same first initial. Okay, it's a cute question. We just had one on Purim, Achashverosh and Esther, both with an Aleph. Okay, Achav and Izevel in the Book of Malachim. The Midrash says that Noach's wife's name was Naama, so you can do that one as well. So my favorite one is Potiphar, Mrs. Potiphar. Okay, anyway. Okay. Her name is not given to us, so that's what we call it. Anyway, so... So we have this, the shlichus component continues after this parsha. So we're going to go into Parshas Mikes. Okay, so turn the page. So anyway, but just to summarize the rest of the story, Yosef is in Potiphar's house and then he gets thrown into prison for on account of the accusation that she throws his way. And there he interprets the dreams of the Sarah Mashkim and the Sarah Ophim, the two officers that are thrown into prison. And of course that whole chapter is important because it lays the groundwork for Yosef to later be taken out of prison. Okay? But insofar as that's an important story for Yosef, but is it an important story for the rest of the family and that other theme of the remaining part of Bereishis? No. I mean, again, it's not insignificant. It is significant, and that's why an entire chapter is dedicated to it. But in terms of the theme that we're trying to follow, of Yaakov's children, that story is one we could just, you know, give a nod to and then move on. So that fellow who Yosef interpreted the dream for, the Sarah Mashkim, if you turn to page 224, he's the one who, after Paro has his dreams that Paro is unable to interpret, he tells Paro about this Na'ar, this young guy who I met in prison, and he could interpret dreams. So Paro says, look at Pasuk Yidalit, Vayishlach Paro. Now Paro is doing shlichus. Paro is sending a message. And what's the message? Vayikras Yosef. He called for Yosef. Vayirisum and Abor, and Yosef was taken out of the pit. Vayigalach, Vayichalev Simulsa, Vayavol Paro. Shaved his clothes, and he was brought before Paro. Okay, so it's the sending, which is the next step before Yosef arrives. Now, after this, does Yosef go back to prison? Until the next time that Paro needs him? No, in this story, Yosef interprets the dreams and tells Paro, hey, you may want to find a guy, wink wink, you know, who can take care of all the things that needs to be done during the years of plenty. And Paro says, you're the guy. And so Yosef does not become, does not go back to prison. Okay, and the rest of that chapter describes how Yosef oversees the things which are needed to be done in Egypt in order to preserve food for the coming years. Page 232. Okay, we're up to chapter 42. Okay, chapter 42. This is where Act 1 ends. Okay? The story could end. Go, Joseph, right? The story could end here. But I'm sure that's what's still on your mind is the family that Joseph left behind. Do you remember? Okay, anyway, chapter 42. So Yaakov sees, you know what? There's no food here, but there is food in Egypt. And so, in verse 4... He sends his sons down. V'yes Binyamin achi Yosef lo shalach Yaakov esachav. Yaakov does not send Binyamin down, and that decision becomes the major source of the beautiful source of conflict in the parshas which follow. And what I mean, not parshas, I mean it's the rest of parshas Miketz. What I mean, beautiful source of conflict, because what makes for interesting narrative and interesting literature. I think about any short story or any book or play, what peaks in, or movie, right? What is interesting is when there is conflict, because how is that going to be resolved? So that particular point of not sending Binyamin is this source of conflict. So much so that when Yosef discovers and realizes that these are his brothers, turn the page 234, smack in the middle of the page, verse 16, okay, 42:16. Yosef says, you know, when they mention that they have a younger brother, Yosef says, all right, shilchu mikem echad, v'yikach es achichem, v'atem yasru v'yibachanu d'vrechem, v'ayim esetchem imlo. I want you guys to send one of you up there, up back up home, to get your brother. And with that, we're going to test you. See if you're telling the truth. Now, it's not so simple. Yosef does change his mind and says, after they're in prison for 3 days, he says, all right, I'm going to let you all go, but if you want more food, you're going to have to come down and bring your brother with you. So that, again, is just feeding the seeds of this conflict, which needs to be played out. Now it's interesting that Yosef puts them in prison. What's the significance of 3 days? Okay, these are questions I'm throwing out there, but I'm not going to answer them. Okay, let's look at the next Shlichus, which takes place. Chapter 43. Okay? Yeah. Page 238. Okay? Now, before we get to chapter 43, another point that I want to make, because I'm going to summarize the who is the leader discussion later on, and I don't want to have to go back to all these things. So if you take a look, so Yosef took Shimon and left him in prison. So when they come back up from Egypt, they're actually missing Shimon. So Shimon's there, and that's why Yaakov gets really upset and says in verse 36, almost the middle of 238, he says, you guys really messed up. Yosef einenu, Shimon einenu, v'esbanyamin tikachu alayhu ayu chulana. You know, Yosef's gone, Shimon's gone, now you're going to take away Binyamin. Everything's fallen upon me. So who steps up to the plate? Reuven. Reuven says, Elaviv lemor, eshnei banai tamis. And that's also a fascinating question. What does that mean? My sons will die? Is that what he's trying to say to Yaakov? Or is he trying to say that I'll have the responsibility? Because, you know, you have lost two sons, or if two sons are lost, then I will bear that responsibility in some way. Some say he's offering to give up a share of the world to come. Different possibilities, but Yaakov does not accept Reuven's offer. So give him to me. And Yaakov says, no, my son is not going down with, what's Imachem? With you singular, Reuven, or with all of you? Imachem is plural, okay? Now, he's not going down with all of you. Yachiv Meis, because his brother, meaning Yosef, is dead, the brother from the same mother, and Hulu Vador Nishar, he's the only one who's left. If something happens, it's not happening. Okay? So, what happens is, so there was a point in time, I had mentioned earlier, where Yehuda is going to bring language back to somebody, where Yaakov says to the brothers, get food, v'nechyeh v'lo namus, so that we can live and not die. Okay, that's an earlier verse, okay, which for whatever reason I skipped and I apologize. But here, the Ra'av gets more heavy, and then Yaakov says, all right guys, time to go back and get more food. So, Yehuda mentions in 43, 4 and 5, okay, that we told the fella, and he said, if you will send our brother with us, then we can go and get food. But if you do not send Lone Raid, then we cannot go down. The fella said, we cannot see him without our brother. So Yaakov, or Yisrael, says, why? What have you done? Why did you tell him all this stuff? And Yehuda says, look, he asked us questions and we had to answer him. We had no reason to lie. Pasukhes, Yomer Yehuda El Yisrael, Aviv, I'm on page 240, verse 8. Yehuda says, Shilcha Hanar Iti, Venakuma Venelecha. You have to send the boy with me, and we will go. Vinichyev Velonamus, we will live and not die. That's the language that Yaakov had used earlier. And Yehuda is saying, the only way that we can get food is if you accept that I am taking this responsibility. Vinichyev Velonamus, that we can live and not die. Us, you, our children, etc. And then Yehuda says, the line which is essentially gets Yaakov convinced to take him, to allow Yehuda to take him, Anochi Ervenu. Miyadi tivak shenu. I will personally guarantee him of my own hand. You can demand him if I don't bring him back to you. So that's verse 8. So finally, what does Yaakov say? In verse 13, he says, Esachichem kachu, you can take him. Pasuk 14, last on the page, 240, Ve'el Shaddai yitem lachem rachamim ufnei ha'ish, v'shilach lachem esachichem, Acher v'es Binyamin. So I hope that El Shaddai will grant you mercy before the man, that he may release to you your other brother, referring to Shimon, as well as Binyamin. V'anochi kasher shakalti. We saw that verse in the class last week, and comparing this story to the Megillah, where Yaakov says, you know, if I have been bereaved, so I am bereaved. Okay, so this is where the shlichus goes in a direction which is very helpful. Why? Well, what's Yosef's plan? That's a fascinating question. Does Yosef want to take Binyamin and not send him back? Does Yosef want to see if Binyamin's alive? Or one of the most beautiful for me interpretations that I found just so fantastic is that when they come down with Binyamin, and then Yosef sends them back with the food. Remember, he plants the cup in Binyamin's bag. He also puts their money in all of their bags. So what Yosef is testing is, what do you do when you are given money for the son of Rachel? How do you respond? Because that's what happens, right? They're given money to bring Binyamin down, or to take so that he can take Binyamin as a slave. How do you respond? So it's a form of a test, because that's what happened if they in fact sold Yosef when they were given money for a son of Rachel. So these are some of the examples of shlichus. We are running out of time, so I just want to. You can look at all these other references, but you see it carries all the way through most of Parshas Vayigash as well, where they talk about the shlichus and what has brought them to this point. Okay, now what happens after this is the beginning of Parshas Vayigash, in which when Binyamin is the sacrificial lamb, in the sense that Yosef is saying he's going to become my slave, the rest of you can go home. And who stands up to defend Binyamin? Not only to defend Binyamin, but ready to give up everything for Binyamin? The answer is, it's Yehuda. Yehuda is the one who told Yaakov that I'm going to take care of it, no matter what. And Yehuda says, listen, I cannot go back up to my father, so you're going to take me as a slave. I'm much more capable, I'm much stronger, and whatever it is that I bring to the table. But Binyamin has to go back home. And that speech that Yehuda gives at the beginning of Parshas Vayigash comes to, it really breaks Yosef, and the veneer, you know, is done, and he breaks down, and he tells them, okay, guys, it's me, and that just is a trigger that brings the family down, and as Yosef tells them, you can come down, I'm going to take care of you, and Yosef does in fact take care of them for the rest of his life, which brings us to the end of the book of Bereishis. So what is the point? So we see that shlichus, the idea of people sending, like Yaakov, for example, sends Yehuda down to set things up, as Yehuda shalach lefanav, and there are also messages being sent, you know, to send Yosef to know that your father's dying, to come get a final blessing from him, and to bring Menashe and Ephraim. Yosef sends wagons to pick up his father, you know, a little before that, to come down. Paro also sends messages, okay, who's going to be this kind of role in Egypt? What are you guys going to play? There's a lot of people sending back and forth, because it's the connections which are forged through the sending, or in the case of not sending Binyamin, that people make in creating this web of a story with all the different branches that break off. You know, there's the Yehuda component, there's the Reuben component, there's the Yosef component, there's the Binyamin component, and the way everybody fits into that is what defines the story of the Bnei Yisrael. I mean, just think about what's, you know, one of the parshas that leads us all off is Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanav. Yaakov sends messages to Esau at the very beginning of all this as well. So it's the idea of connection, which exists when you're sending things to one another, whether it's gifts or messages, and that is what defines, in a sense, the end of this book, the different connections that exist between members of the family in creating the narrative as we know it, which plays out with the sons of Yaakov. But the last thing which I wanted to talk about is this struggle between Reuben, Yehuda, and Yosef. Now, what goes in each person's favor? Well, Reuben is the firstborn, the actual firstborn, firstborn of Leah. Yosef has a similar claim. He's the firstborn of Rachel. And in terms of the two of those, and their, you know, whether you want to call it a conflict or not, Reuben has two major moments where he could shine. And in both cases, he kind of fails, you know, in a way. That's in saving Yosef. I mean, he does save Yosef from being killed, yes, but he doesn't save Yosef completely because he could have brought Yosef home, but he did not. And when he tried to do that, he was too late. And the other one is the one which we just saw, when he said that he was going to take care of Binyamin, but he did not really take care of, but Yaakov did not accept his offer. In contrast, by the way, Yehuda has two major episodes, one in the sale of Yosef and in taking care of Binyamin. But in both cases, Yehuda is more listened to, which just goes to demonstrate that his leadership prowess is much more prominent. The brothers listen to Yehuda with regard to selling Yosef. Yaakov listens to Yehuda with regard to protecting Binyamin. Another major episode that we saw with both Reuven and Yehuda, is that Reuven, whatever he did with Bilhah, unclear, right? But Reuven, that was something which just he had to deal with on his own. He never had a chance to kind of do an open or public tshuva. Whereas Yehuda, with Tamar, he had the opportunity. And what did he do? He said, she's right, I'm the father. Okay, so you see that in similar kinds of circumstances, Reuven and Yehuda kind of emerges in a significant way to be that kind of leader. Now Yosef, as a Bechor, well, Yosef's story is completely different, and it's because of the fact that he's sent down to Egypt with this dream interpreting power that he has that turns him into be able to rise to the position that he has. But the narrative also focuses very heavily on Yosef to see how Yosef stands out in all different kinds of challenges. I mean, just to give the example of Reuven, Yehuda, and Yosef. Yosef also had a similar kind of encounter. We skipped it, but that's Yosef with Mrs. Potiphar. And what did Yosef do? Right, Yosef, of the three brothers, he's the only one who didn't succumb at all.
Yeah.
Right? We don't know what Reuven did with Bilhah, okay? But we can leave it. The pasuk seems to say that he and Bilhah went at it. And that Yehuda and Tamar obviously did, because Tamar was pregnant. Yosef's the only one who, when the situation arose, he ran away. Which is why Yosef is referred to as Yosef Hatzadik, in the way that the other brothers are not. Not we call them all tzadikim, but we never refer to any of them as name Hatzadik. So Yosef does emerge, but in the end, what we have more than anything is an eternal. I don't want to call it a clash, but it's not really a clash or a conflict, but and when I say battle, I mean a battle like the way Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel had a battle. You know, it's a battle between Yosef and Yehuda. And that, in fact, is what we have for all time. Because in the land of Israel later on, when the kingdom split, right, after the death of Shlomo, the kingdom split into two kingdoms. One we call Malchus Yehuda, that was in Judea, and the other one, which is called Malchus Yisrael, but is also often referred to as Malchus Ephraim. Who's Ephraim? Son of Yosef. Because most of the kings were from the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Not all of them, but most of them. Or at least the largest number, I should say, of any tribe was from those tribes. And so you have that, you know, was it a conflict? Sometimes there was civil war, but sometimes not. It was just, you know, I wouldn't even call it a cold peace. But that's what you have, Yehuda and Yosef. And for the future, that's what we have as well. We talk about Mashiach ben David, and we talk about Mashiach ben Yosef. That these are the things which are going to happen sometime in the future. The last point that I'm going to make with respect to all of this is the final issue of Yehuda versus Yosef is at the splitting of the sea. So we have a tradition, of course, not a tradition, it's in the Torah, that when they left Egypt, they took Yosef's bones, right? But the tradition is that not only did they take Yosef's bones, but that they took the bones of, no, Yaakov was already buried, of all the brothers. Okay, the Gemara Makos has an example of what happened at the splitting of the sea. Hayam ra'av ayanos, right? We say this in Hala. Hayam ra'av ayanos. The sea saw and it ran away. What did it see and ran away? It saw the bones of all the brothers. It said, okay, you know what? Let's make room. That's why there, one of the interpretations is that there were 12 tunnels for each tribe to go through. One for each, because the tribe was, because that the shaven, the person was actually there. So the thing was, the Gemara talks about this, that Yehuda's bones were rattling. Okay, they were rattling. Oh, I think it was Yehuda. Yeah, yeah. Or Reuven. I don't, you know, I don't remember which one it is, actually. It talks about Reuven and Yehuda. And the Gemara asks the question, Migaram, Migaram, the Reuven, Shehoda, Yehuda. Okay? So the neshama of each one was saying, why do my bones have to rattle? Yosef's bones aren't rattling. And they used this example of Yehuda admitting what he had done with Tamar that served as an inspiration for Reuven to do a full tshuva of whatever it was that he did with Bilhah. Okay? Which again just goes to show that whatever Reuven did and whatever Yehuda did, who emerged on top? Yehuda. Yehuda could serve as an inspiration. Yehuda, a character who was flawed. Remember, he's the one who was behind the sale of Yosef. But by the end of the story, where's Yehuda? I mean, he's way on top. Who does Yaakov send down to Egypt to set things up? Yosef's already there. You think Yosef didn't send up the right infrastructure? Who does Yaakov send up? Yes, Yehuda, Shalach Lefanav. Yaakov sends down Yehuda. Okay, so we see what emerges. And it's something which is, in a way, it's an eternal conflict. Who's supposed to rise? Who's supposed to be on top? But at the same time, we're all the Shivteka, all of the servants of, not servants, the Shvatim, all part of the nation of Am Yisrael. And hopefully one day we can recognize that it's not about who is on top or about what's most important. As long as we have a nation and we are united and that we can all do what we need to do and fill our role, that is where Reuven, Yehuda, and Yosef, they should each find their proper place and should each serve properly within the realm of what is considered to be all of Am Yisrael. And this is just a microcosm. The Book of Bereishis is a microcosm of the beginnings of our nation. And remember, we have to end where we began. The first Rashi in the Book of Bereishis is, what do we need all this for? Why can't we just start from the first mitzvah in the Torah? The first mitzvah in the Torah is Hachodesh Etzelachem. And the answer that Rashi gives is Koach Ma'asav Yigid Li'amo, that the Bnei Yisrael needed to know who we are. Where do we come from? Why do we have this nation of tribes, this nation that call ourselves Bnei Yisrael? And the answer is the Book of Bereishis. The Book of Bereishis. So it's something which we need to know very well, not just because the stories are fun or cute, but because it is the beginning of the nation that we attach ourselves to, the nation of Israel. And we need to know, what are our personality traits? Where do they come from? They come from these people. They come from these stories. The Musar that we learn from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, from the tribes, the conflicts which they had, how they emerged. One of the last things that emerges is when Yaakov gives a bracha to Manasseh and Ephraim. What does he say? He says, Yisimcha Elohim Kefraim Chivnasha. That's the way we're going to bless our children. And the interpretation I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik, I didn't hear from him, but I heard his name, is that we bless our children, at least our sons, that they should be like Manasseh and Ephraim, because Manasseh and Ephraim are the first brothers in all the Torah who didn't fight. And that is an important message that we want to give to our children, the Olam Va'ed, that we should be blessed and not fight, to get along, because that's where our strength is. When we, in Israel, get along, we can achieve whatever it is that we need to. And halavai, that should be the case for all of us and for Achinu B'nai Israel.